Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Good evening and welcome to Views of the News, the show that brings you an analysis of media performance from many points of view. This week is no exception, as we'll take a look at criticisms of the conservative media in the wake of President Obama's election victory, the multiple problems confronting the BBC, and at home, a specific problem facing Chicago journalists. Just when you thought it was safe, we'll also talk about Black Friday and shopping creep, the sort you can find on your smartphone. I'm your substitute host, Lee Wilkins, and with me in the Reynolds Journalism Institute studio, our regular panelist, Charles Davis, our expert on freedom of information concerns, and Amy Simons, a member of the Journalism School's Convergence faculty with an expertise in and love for political reporting. Before we launch into the program, I need to set the record straight. The School of Journalism and the Reynolds Journalism Institute was the beneficiary of enormous generosity last week, specifically a $30 million donation to endow the ongoing work of the Reynolds Center. Most listeners to this program who are affiliated with the university understand what that means. But my mother-in-law doesn't fall into that category. So when she asked me over the weekend what I was going to do with my raise, it took me a while to understand why she was posing the question. So for those listeners who don't pay close attention to the insider baseball of university finances, we need to assure you that none of that $30 million wound up in faculty, staff, or administrators' paychecks. The money will support the ongoing programs at RJI, but it is not targeted at the daily work of teaching, research, and service at the School of Journalism. That doesn't mean we aren't grateful. It just means we don't, as individuals, have any more money to spend. Now that I've cleared that up, I'd like to focus on part of the election postmortem we really didn't have a chance to discuss much last week, the role of the conservative-leaning or affiliated media in the election outcome. This week, in a variety of venues, there has been some reporting and much analysis on whether the conservative media failed its audience base, the conservative donor base, and what that might mean going forward. We'll tackle that question, including what could be construed as a renewed faith in the mainstream media when it comes to political reporting. Public broadcasting, this time in England, has taken a series of body blows in the last 2 weeks, not unlike the ones sustained by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and National Public Radio in the U.S. over the past 18 months. Over the weekend, the head of the BBC resigned, less than 2 months after he had accepted the job, over a badly flawed report which inaccurately accused one of former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher's political allies of child molestation. We'll talk about how the British pay for the BBC, its changing role in British political and entertainment culture, and the political capital the BBC may now have to spend to retain its funding base as well as its journalistic reputation. Amy's going to bring us up to date on the latest goings on in Chicago, namely city government's decision to record journalists doing the work of journalism without their knowledge. And if you just can't wait to get out the door on Thanksgiving, or even in the wee hours after Thanksgiving, we got the apps for you. On our blog, we have reviews of some of the most popular Black Friday apps. More pertinent to this show is the impact of this sort of direct-to-the-consumer advertising via smartphones and what that might mean for the traditional retail advertising that has weighed down newspapers and flooded the airwaves as this season of giving and gifting begins in earnest. That's a reasonably full plate, so let's start with our favorite meal, politics. There has been a lot of discussion in the past week about how the conservative media may have contributed to former Governor Romney's electoral defeat. Here's John Stewart's take.
Would the blame for it go to their own willful blindness, their eager supping of a misinformation gruel they themselves cooked up and had to, at some deep level of cognition, know contained far more than the FDA allowance of bullshit?
the white establishment is now the minority.
I just cannot believe, though, that the majority of Americans would believe that incurring more debt is good for our economy, for our children's future, for job creators.
It's not a traditional America anymore. And there are 50% of the voting public who want stuff.
I cannot believe that the majority of Americans would believe that it's okay not to follow the Constitution and not have a budget.
Who is going to give them things? President Obama. People feel that they are entitled to things.
Holy balls.
Amy, did conservatives essentially fool themselves by limiting their information diet to a very select number of media outlets?
Well, it's kind of been what the practice has become as of late. And people's, for better or for worse, people's news diet and their choices of news outlets have become whatever it is that their political leanings tend to favor. And as a result, here you saw a lot of conservative America thinking they had this thing in the bag because they were only listening to themselves. They were talking to and listening to themselves. And as a result, it came as shock and awe to
Charles,
so many.
What do you, I mean, how do you respond to that? Is this part of just tunnel vision warped to the nth degree?
Well, I think the media model of conservative media is broken. We've talked about it many times on the show, the fact that Fox has left the building when it comes to news gathering. They've become something else entirely. They are a propagandistic arm of the Republican Party. And thus, they served their electorate really, really poorly when the electorate turned to them for news, because they stopped being a news gathering organization some time ago. In our introductory course here, Principles of American Journalism, we talk about a couple of things. We talk about a lot of things, but we spend a lot of time on distance from faction and engaged independence. If you take those terms and think about them for only a second, you can see very quickly that Fox fails miserably on both counts. And we think that that is very instrumental to doing journalism versus something else.
Amy, some pundits have even suggested that this sort of problem will mean a content change for some organizations and a move by viewers and readers and listeners toward the mainstream media. Is that just wishful thinking on the part of journalists who have one foot in the legacy camp, or do you think there's something to it?
Right now, I think it's wishful thinking, only because I'm looking at what I'm still hearing on the radio today. I'm looking at what is still going on TV today, and there are still people calling into talk radio who think that there is some big conspiracy and this can all somehow be undone, and that the world will be right again when they have their chance, even if they have to wait. And wait another 4 years, may or may not happen. But with what happened last Tuesday night, towards the end of the evening, I started waiting for the speeches to start, watching and flipping through all of the stations, and landed on MSNBC. And Rachel Maddow was actually telling the audience to go over to Fox and watch the craziness that was going on there, and describing Karl Rove's breakdown and demanding that Fox call Ohio back for Romney. And at that point, turned over to watch, and it was, when you say that, it's they've lacked this disengagement because they are now so closely intertwined. It was the perfect example of just watching it blow up in our faces, journalists, if that's what they are.
Charles, you did a little driving in Missouri today and on your way to getting to the show, and I understand you went through some southern portions of the state and spent some time listening to talk radio. What did you hear?
They're not coping really well. There was a lot of anger, a lot of resentment, a lot of unveiled talk of open insurrection. In fact, the word secession was thrown around. The word coup was thrown around, which I thought was incredibly irresponsible. To their credit, several other callers called in very quickly on the heels of those calls and sort of talked them down and said, let's not be irresponsible here. But there is a tremendous amount of disillusionment, I think, on many members of the right, in large part because their media apparatus did fail them so spectacularly. So there was a lot of conversation about the fact that we never saw this coming, in large part, how could they have seen it coming? I mean, if you watched the glad handing and the cheerleading that took place by Mr. Rove, by Dick Morris, by countless others, on a channel that pretty much, if you're in the GOP camp these days, you're watching it at the exclusion of everything else. I just don't know how you get an alternate version of reality.
Well, I also wonder if this isn't a place when there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, the difference in generations. I was talking with Barney Kalame, who's visiting here from the Wall Street Journal, yesterday after a talk he gave about the Wall Street Journal post Murdoch. And one of the things he said was he was pointing to a news story where they had moved up the journal staff, that is, high in the story. A phrase about Barack Obama is that Barack Obama, comma, community organizer, meant as a slam. And as Barney and I were talking, I said, you know, to people under a certain age, a community organizer is Martin Luther King. A community organizer is Rosa Parks. A community organizer is a term of honor and endearment to one generation, whereas to another generation means something entirely. So I'm sort of wondering if there isn't a lot going on here. I don't want to go as far as to say never trust anybody over 30, but I think words are being interpreted quite differently depending on who's doing the listening. Charles, you're frowning at me.
Oh, sure. No, I agree. But I mean, go back to that moment in which I was sitting watching Karl Rove argue with the Fox staff over the Ohio results, and you sort of step back from that a second and go, wait a minute, that guy ran a super PAC raising money for and spending money for Republican candidates all across the country. What is he doing on the air on what purports to be a news channel covering an election that he is directly, not indirectly, directly involved in? We've reached a point where sort of the absurdity of that moment crystallizes everything we're saying. It's a broken model. And they're going to have to either figure it out or just say, we no longer do news. We don't purport to do news. What we do is cheerlead.
Well, I'm going to take that as sort of the last word on that topic and move us on across the pond a bit. The BBC has had a terrible couple of weeks. Charles, I know that both you and I have had the joy of teaching in England and that we are both big fans of the Beeb. But I also think a lot of Americans don't quite understand how British public broadcasting is financed. So before we begin this discussion, how does the BBC get its money?
From a license fee, sort of like, you know, the way you pay your Mediacom bill around here, you pay an annual bill to the British government if based on how many television sets you have in your home. And they go around once a year and go, give me your pounds, please. And on the basis of that and some other appropriations, the Beeb puts together a $6 billion annual budget. It is a massive organization. And the most important, I would say, the most important cultural institution in British life, overwhelmingly.
So, Amy, it's an important cultural institution, but I think it's also set a lot of standards for how you do news, especially international news outside of the U.S. So what are the sorts of things you think the BBC is known for before we get to, oh, my goodness, here's the goof?
Well, you know, when I think of the BBC, the first thing I think of is war reporting. Even if it's going back to everything that I've learned about World War II, I think of the BBC as being the gold standard in international and in war reporting and being one of the most trusted voices in that around the globe.
Well, so American news organizations sometimes get things wrong, sometimes horribly wrong. Mm-hmm. But in the past week, the Beeb has really had a couple of corkers. A word that I learned when I was in England was gobsmacked. And I think that there are a lot of people who work for the Beeb who are exactly that, Not to mention the British public. So first off, do you think that this is sort of a tipping point for the BBC, that they're likely to lose some journalistic stature over these two horrible, horrible mistakes?
I think they will on some level, but at the same time, if you look at even what we were just talking about a few minutes ago and how an entire political party can almost take over a television network and turn it into its own cheerleading source, I think people are going to recognize this as a mistake, and the legacy and the decades of reporting, I don't see it all being wiped out by one story.
Charles, what do you think? I mean, the BBC is at a, I don't want to say a crucial time, but there's a lot of commercial competition in Britain when there didn't used to be.
There is, and there's a lot of glee on the part of the Murdochs and others about what's happening. I think at the institutional, the high-end management level, what you're going to see is just 100% turnover. You're going to see wholesale. Well, you've already
seen two resignations.
You're going to see six or eight before it's over with. The entire top of that org chart is going to flip. And I think, by the way, it needs to. Any editorial decision-making process that results in a member of parliament being labeled a child molester when the subject is then presented with a photograph of the person and says, oh, wait a minute, that's not him, that boggles the mind. I mean, it really, you have to wonder on the basis of what identification did you make such an allegation?
Well, and I thought it was really telling, at least the part of the BBC that I heard this morning, where the man who has resigned, George Entwistle, was talking about what he knew and when he knew it, and to the just sort of the increasingly shrill questioning of, what do you mean you didn't know? Isn't it your job to know? And he said really he didn't, he was not in the loop, the editorial decision making loop. So I mean, Amy, how do they survive that? I mean, is changing the org chart, do you think, going to be enough?
I think changing the org chart is a big first step. I think part of what's going to make it possible for the BBC to survive is going to be its international reputation and its international audience, because I think it's going to be people here in the United States, it's going to be people in different parts of the world who aren't as inundated with this. I don't know that this story is as well known here in America, or that any of this has happened, as it is all over Europe right now, as it is within journalism circles. And I think that's going to be part of what makes it easy for the BBC to survive.
Well, Charles, you mentioned a story that I put on the blog about Rupert Murdoch decrying all of this at BBC, but I don't think Rupert Murdoch ever decries anything for no good reason. So follow me a little bit on the conspiracy theory here. Why is it that Murdoch in particular might be weighing in on this scandal?
Oh, well, I think he's gleeful on a couple of levels. One, it pushes him off the scandal sheet, which he spent a lot of time on in the last couple of years. Secondly, as you know, he's been trying to buy a bigger chunk of BSkyB TV across Europe, and I think he thinks that this will kind of shift the regulatory pressure off of him and on to the BBC, and the longer that story stays on the front of UK tabloids, the happier he is.
Well, Amy, you brought this next story to our attention. So if I'm a journalist covering Chicago City Hall, the city is... right? It's now recording my interviews without my knowledge?
Well, there's a question as to how many recordings exactly have been made. Came out in some reporting yesterday, and it should be noted it came out in a story that was in the Chicago Tribune, that there had been at least one conversation that was known of for sure between two reporters actively and a third sitting in the room interviewing the police superintendent about a year ago, having to do with a story about a lawsuit related to a police-involved shooting. And it's been discovered that this conversation was recorded by City Hall officials without the knowledge of the three reporters who were party to that call. And that's problematic because, unlike here in Missouri, Illinois is a two-party state, which means everybody involved needs to give permission before being recorded. And, I mean, I should say the three reporters who were involved in this, Steve Mills, who is an amazing investigative reporter who, along with Maurice Posley, has been instrumental in the reporting and the moratorium on the death penalty in the state of Illinois. So he's somebody that politicians tend to be a little bit afraid of. Stacey Sinclair, who's a graduate of our School of Journalism here, and Jeremy Gorner are all stellar reporters. Also should be noted, I came here from the Chicago Tribune. So, you know, my opinion of these folks is high because I would count them not only as former colleagues, but as friends.
So, Charles, let's dig into this a little more. How does it happen that something that's a felony in Illinois is perfectly legally acceptable in Missouri? And then we'll get to the ethics of it in a minute.
Well, eavesdropping statutes are state-level statutes, and they vary widely from state to state. There are a number of one-party states, a number of two-party states. So it's like everything else, really. When you look at media law, it's this patchwork quilt of statutes across the country, and there's a variable standard. This is a really amazing unfolding story. And as Amy said, I did some reading this morning too, and you just can't really tell. It's too early to know where this is going to go. This much we know. There are serious legal implications to what has happened. This story is certainly not going away, and it seems fairly clear from the reading that at least three journalists have been. I mean, it's very clear that the conversation was recorded and that they have it.
Oh, the city has acknowledged it, and on Monday, was this was all coming together, two other news organizations pressed the mayor on this at a news conference on an unrelated event, and the mayor acknowledged that these go on, and then he blew it all off and actually said it was much ado about nothing. He has much more serious things to worry about and to consider and to put his time in against.
Actually, of all the things that we've said so far, I found Rahm Emanuel's statements just a little bit breathtaking, because he, of all people, should know that something that starts out looking like he's got much more important problems to consider, by the time it gets to the courts and everybody's subpoenaing your records, this is going to be the most important problem you have to consider for a good long while.
Well, and he was quite flippant in how he said the much ado about nothing, watching it on the PBS station's website this morning.
Well, Missouri is a one-party state, and at least when I teach about this, I tell students that while it may be legal, it ain't ethical to record somebody without their consent. You're all doing a wonderful job of reinforcing my opinion by nodding and smiling at me, but I would really like to go into that. I mean, why is it important for journalists in some sense to let people know that they're being taped?
Well, it's fraught with ethical problems, like you say. If you're going to tape anyone without their consent, whether you have legal coverage or not, it's almost irrelevant from a journalistic perspective, because the ethics, I think, are even more important. And that is, are you going to engage in what I think is a pretty deceptive news gathering practice and call someone on the phone and have a conversation with them, not intimating in any way that you're recording that conversation? And that is dangerous stuff.
Amy, we've got instances of journalists sitting in the lavatory and putting microphones through ventilating shafts so that they can record what's going on next door. We obviously have all sorts of now miniaturized recording equipment, you know, and some of that's video equipment as well. Popular segments on a lot of television shows are essentially, you know, the spy cam goes into, oh, I don't know, we could have done it in Columbia to go in and see if there were cockroaches in restaurants. No media outlet did that, I want to emphasize. So, I mean, viewers like it. It's popular television. So what's our problem?
Well, our problem, the first thing I'm thinking about is the example that you provide. That's private property. You don't have a right, even if it's a one-party or two-party state, you don't have a right to walk onto somebody else's property and just start recording things without their permission. You can't just walk into a restaurant and just start shooting things with cameras, of course.
Well, why is it that you think, oh dear, or maybe with anything else, why is it that you think that it's so popular with viewers? And in a certain way, it's popular with readers as well.
Oh, it's voyeuristic.
It's voyeuristic.
People enjoy looking in on others.
And think going back to, you know, the Mike Wallace gotcha ambush interview on 60 Minutes. People loved watching that stuff. And that's what TV news almost became identified with.
Okay. Well, so we're not going to have that camera, although there are times that I wish I could have a camera for the day after Thanksgiving shopping frenzy, which I guess if I'm reading things correctly, is not the day after Thanksgiving. It's the hour after the meal is over Thanksgiving shopping frenzy. So I'm going to start with a really simple question. Charles or Amy, do either of you have a Black Friday app on your smartphone yet?
Without question, no, because my Black Friday consists of vegetating on or near a couch.
I'm with
I don't darken the doors of any retail establishment on that Friday. Never will.
I actually last year needed to go to Walmart to pick up some things and went at about 11:30, 12 o'clock on Black Friday to pick up something on an errand. There was no one there. I was like the only person in the store. So if you ever need to go to a big box retailer for whatever reason, lunchtime on Black Friday
makes
is the
sense.
Time to go.
They've all left by then.
Okay, so now that we've cleared up the fact that
we're not Black Friday
shoppers,
we're
not participating in this frenzy. But I would like to talk a little bit about, in some sense, what that means more deeply. Because one of the things that, for example, these apps will show you, and there's already been some advertising around it, is now we know what the sales are going to be all about. We know when they're going to start. Retailers are saying things like, well, you know, on your app, you're going to get notice of sales that we're not advertising in any other way. And I think that that's interesting at a number of levels. So I want to pull it apart a little bit. So, Amy, what do you think this means for traditional Black Friday advertising, like the kind you might find in Thursday's newspaper or the kind you might see Thursday or Thursday evening on television?
I think what a lot of these advertisers are banking on is the ability to get information out of their shoppers. Because all of that circular advertising that just shows up in the newspaper, that's all one-way advertising right there. They're giving you information, that's it. If they can get you to download an app, you have to give permissions on every app that you download. It could be your GPS information. It could be your contact list and your phone book. So if they can get you to do this via app, you're giving up a ton of information to the marketer and to the retailer that they wouldn't get otherwise.
Charles, what are some other implications here?
In fact, I have a student writing a paper for my media law class on the nature of consent and privacy right now, which is really quite interesting. And what she's looking at are a lot of these opt-in, purely voluntary, consent-driven, incredibly intrusive marketing campaigns on behalf of retailers. There's one that it's a cell phone app. It's called Shopkick. If you haven't seen it, it uses geolocation to tag you and you sort of check in at a retailer. Hey, I'm at Macy's. Well, they already know that because they've got a geolocation device that's tracked your phone anyway. So if you register with Shopkick, it will send you a message that says, hey, see you're at Macy's. Here's a $5 off coupon if you try on some jeans today. They are experimenting with putting on the barcodes on clothing in Macy's information that will hook you up with your phone so that the phone knows what you are trying on and incentivizes you as you try on clothes, right? This is fantastically creepy from a privacy standpoint.
It absolutely is.
But again, the consumer at every turn is opting into these things, right? So Shopkick has turned to the consumer going, do you want more coupons and incentives? Yes, yes, yes. And as you say yes, 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 their intrusive level sort of rises with each consenting click. And it raises very real questions about the nature of consent and whether that consent is truly informed or whether it's leveraged by these offers.
Well, I'm curious also because all of this, of course, is done. It's sort of one-to-many kind of communication, although it doesn't feel that way. We got a whole bunch of students who are majoring in strategic communication. Mm-hmm. And at least as I look at some of this stuff, they've pretty much been cut out of that loop. I mean, there's no development of an advertising campaign. There's no clever slogan. There's no cute jingle, or any of that sort of stuff. Do you think, Amy, they should be worried?
They should come to Convergence where we're teaching app development.
In some cases, that's the case. But in a lot of cases, what you're seeing is digital marketing and advertising campaigns built in with accompanying apps.
It's the next generation. It's showing where there needs to be evolution within the strategic communication industry is what it is.
Well, I guess I'm less sanguine about that than either of the two of you because I see this as something that ultimately will be done by algorithms and programmers. And that sort of the part of the creative business of advertising that I've always thought that our students most identified with, I don't see that being involved in a serious way in this same thing.
I think the function will be what you're talking about, but it's still going to need the interface. It's still going to need the user experience that the creativity comes through.
Well, as usual, we've run out of time before we've run out of things to say. We'd also like to hear from you and welcome your comments on the blog you can reach through kbia.org. Go to the tab marked Talk Shows and then find Views of the News. This program would not be even remotely possible without some able technical support from Technical Director Travis McMillan and Audio Director Pat Akers. Views won't be with you next week. We're going to take the day before Thanksgiving off, apparently to do something other than shop. Mike McKean will return to hosting duties in 2 weeks. Since I was fortunate enough to hear Dr. Maya Angelou on Monday evening, I'd like to borrow a few words from her. May you all take the chance to become the rainbow in someone's cloud. Good evening. This is Lee Wilkins for Views of the News.